If I could have your attention, I'd like to introduce a really outstanding lunch program we have today with two very well-known scholars, Robert Jervis and Philip Zelikow. And our speaker today is Robert Jervis, the Adlai E. Stevenson Professor of International Affairs at Columbia University. His work is, of course, is well known to any student of international relations. And he's one of the soup-to-nut guys in international relations. That is, some people divide the field into levels of analysis. International relations is shaped by people, shaped by states, and is shaped by the international system. And Professor Jervis has written landmark books at each of those levels, landmark works. Perception and Misperception in International Politics, on the Effects of Psychology on International Relations, remains, although it was written in 1976, a seminal text on psychology and international relations. He's one of the few people to write an article that has had as much weight in the field as almost any book. That article, Cooperation Under the Security Dilemma, today still finds itself on virtually every syllabus there is on international relations. And his work has expanded, of course, to the international system as well, with his groundbreaking book on system effects that looks at interaction, feedback, and complexity at the overall level of international relations. Jervis is not just a theory expert, but he's also a specialist on security affairs. His book, The Meaning of the Nuclear Revolution, won the prestigious and very well-paying Grawemeyer Award. We're all envious of that. And he's also one of the few cross-dressers out there. That is, he looks as good in political science garb as he does in history garb. He knows more about history than any political scientist I know, and I know that seems like a backhanded compliment in this audience. But he really does have an incredible knowledge of diplomatic history. Today he's going to be speaking on troop withdrawals. Salted peanuts are doing more with less. Please welcome Professor Robert Jervis.
Thank you, Jeff. And I don't know which is worse, having to suffer through an after lunch or dessert speech or having to give it. But anyway, we'll do the best we can. I'd like to add my note of appreciation to the organizers of this meeting in the Miller Center. It's a marvelous facilities and really fascinating, and I really did enjoy all the other papers that I've read. I think it's just very stimulating, and it is, as Jeff reminds, a great pleasure for me to be among so many historians, because I couldn't do my work without you people making sense of some of these events so that I can then make up stories about them. My paper is in three or four not terribly tightly integrated sections. The first is the general problem of the setting and partly the relation of domestic and international politics. And of course, this has partly been covered in the morning. The second is something called the commitment trap, which was also Mark Silverstone's paper touched on that, but I want to go into it in more detail. Then I want to come to what I think is perhaps the central issue, at least historically, in terms of Vietnam, the period we're talking about, which is what difference the 4 years made. It's both an analytic question, of course, a heavily normative question. And then I want to finally raise a puzzle, at least for me, about why Nixon didn't do something that I think would have made good political sense. Okay. On the introductory part, the basic point, of course, is the one that Bob started us off with, and most of the papers stressed, and you people, and sort of obvious, but just want to stress that this the dilemma when you're facing troop withdrawal as a generic question, and it's not in the face of victory, which you could imagine you withdraw troops after you've won or after a successful negotiation, you are inevitably in a position you don't want to be in. This is always bad news. So the sort of general category we're talking about, it would be interesting to generate cases other than the two obvious ones. I think we could, although I can't do it off the top of my head. You know, there, it's always a last resort. You don't do it first. You do it when nothing else works. And that means you, as the decision makers and perhaps the country as a whole, is facing what's seen as a desperate and situation and very bad choices. And in, and I think there are two sub-aspects of that. The one, the obvious one, that you're often facing a trade-off between what you as the leader would like to do in foreign policy and what domestic politics will allow you to do. Because if you don't have that problem, then the course is obvious. You just go ahead and do what you want to do. It's good domestic politics. It's good for the world. You know, it may be difficult, but you do it. But the, you, in the two cases that are obviously on our minds, and I suspect most others we could look at, for the decision maker at least, and many of his or her political allies, the cost of withdrawing is high in either domestic or international terms, or I think the way they saw it, both. So you they find themselves in a dilemma. And the second general point is, comes from my work in political psychology, that I believe when people, decision makers or any of us, are faced in very difficult positions, we tend to fool ourselves. In addition, perhaps, and more fundamentally than fooling others, we tend to pretend the choice isn't as hard as we think and that there is a way of squaring the circle. And I think we find a lot of cases where, in retrospect, we say, how could they believe that? And we adopt, and we'll come to a little more of this, a more cynical explanation than is warranted or completely warranted, when I think what happens is, faced with intolerable choices, people believe that the policy they've chosen will work out in both domestic and international politics. I think we see that both in Iraq and here. Now, the problem of troop withdrawal is especially difficult in democracies, of course, though we can see somewhat similar dilemmas in Soviet Union and Afghanistan. And for the U.S., I think, maybe even particularly true, in that when you're fighting a war for less than vital interests, not World War II, not even World War I, but Korea, you know, Vietnam, we can argue about how important the interests were, but they're not a vital interest in the sense that, you know, the consequence of losing are going to be direct and enormous hits to security. There's an incredible problem about maintaining public support. That's why political scientists Dan Ryder and Alan Stamm have found that democracies tend to win wars they initiate, but that this effect is especially true for short wars. And after a war goes on more than 6 months, the success of democracies tails off very much. And I think the answer is partly leaders know that if they get in a war for less than the most supreme interest and it isn't over quickly, they are in deep trouble. And therefore, you find a lot of wars they win quickly because those are the only wars they're willing to fight. And when they fight in one or the other kind, they run into a lot of trouble. And we've heard, of course, a lot about the trouble, and as usual, I've been running behind, so let me just skip more on that. I've got some more in the paper. Okay. I want to look at a silver lining. That is, we know why withdrawal hurts. As you know, the famous quote for the North Vietnamese said, if you couldn't win with 500,000 men, how are you going to win with 100,000 or not? Okay, so we know that. There is an upside to withdrawal, not complete, but there is some, and that is that it gains you leverage over your ally. We focus a lot on the interaction with the adversary, but really, certainly the Iraq and Vietnamese case, and I think in others that we look at, there's an important interaction between the intervening power and the country, its local indigenous ally. And in many cases, certainly Vietnam and Iraq and many others, the intervening power wants the Allies to do more and to reform. Reform's a vague term, but you know, we could talk more, but let me just use the term generally. The problem is, once you're pledged to protect the ally, you've just given away all your leverage. Your leverage is, if you don't reform, we'll withdraw. And what the leader of the other country, the indigenous leader, knows very well, you can't afford to withdraw because you're married to us and there's no divorce. And my student, Doug McDonald, has a very interesting book called Adventures in Chaos, and American attempts to get reform at South Asian allies in the early years of the Cold War through Vietnam, I think shows that very, very well. And it's interesting that one of the ways McNamara justifies the withdrawing 1,000, he said, we're going to get Diem's attention. You know, now we're going to get some leverage over him. And Johnson couldn't get any leverage. And similarly today, I think Bush has no leverage in Iraq, and never has, of the internal politics, because he can't threaten to withdraw, because he said how important it is to us. And I could, in the paper, I talk a little bit about that in Iraq. I won't do that now. Now, there are two kinds of withdrawal and different kinds of leverage, conditional and unconditional. The obvious advantages are of conditional withdrawal, but it cuts differently with allies and adversaries. With the ally, you'd like to say, we won't withdraw if you really do your share in reform. That's not highly credible, because if the ally really does his share and reforms, then he should be able to stand on his own feet and you should be able to withdraw. But still, you can make some promises there about scope and, you know, timing and giving the ally say, but if you're doing it only conditionally, you know, that's very hard to do. Similarly, with the adversary, and you'd like to make it conditional, and we saw, you know, we know the story of that in Vietnam. It was impossible, or Laird made it impossible. But there are advantages even to unconditional withdrawal, too, because, and this may be really relevant to Iraq, I like to think it is, the ally will see that it's not going to be able to rely on the intervening power indefinitely. And it will face the stark choice of what's it going to do on its own. You know, whether, you know, and it would be interesting to look at that in Vietnamese politics. I can't. I know, you know, nothing about Vietnamese politics. I know nothing about Iraqi politics, but I will, of course, talk very briefly to say about that. But this, of course, is in the hope of those of us who've advocated withdrawal right from the beginning, and that the only way you'll get political compromises in Iraq. The only possibility, I don't think you'll get it under any conditions, but anyway, the only possibility is when we leave. They're not going to do it when we're there. Why should they? We're the safety net for them. Only by pulling out the safety net will you get the sort of changes only pulling out the safety net gives you a chance at getting the changes you want. So even unconditional withdrawal can escape from the commitment trap. It's not a guarantee, but it is a silver lining. Okay. On Vietnam, one of the crucial questions in the withdrawal, and it comes up, it's come up in this conference, comes up in all the discussions, comes up, as we'll talk about later today or tomorrow, on also the retrospectives and the political use of the retrospectives, is, in a sense, you know, Nixon, I think it's clear from what's said here and what we know, that Nixon and Kissinger and even Laird felt they were buying time with Vietnamization. The question is, what did we get for our time? We know the cost. You know, 20,000 American dead. I don't know what the estimate is on Vietnamese, you know, obviously much higher. We know the costs in increasing bitterness, polarization within the U.S., and I think the cost in greater so-called Vietnam syndrome. But I think some of the papers today and some of the historical literature is wrong in saying we didn't get anything with what we paid. Whether what we got was worth the price is the question. I'm going to duck, so I'm going to, but at least I'll tell you I'm ducking it. But I do think it's worth thinking about what we did, what we were able to buy, what the U.S. and Nixon was able to buy with the time. And one thing, obviously, for Nixon came out very much in Ken's paper, I'll come back to, you know, he bought some domestic control or control system of the domestic situation, he felt. Because he, as you know, was very much worried about the counterattacks from the right. I think, and you people who know the period better than I can comment more, that in some ways he was worried more about the right than the left. But at least, even if that's an overstatement, he was certainly very worried about a right-wing backlash against him if he'd gotten out quickly. And he did somewhat manage the domestic situation in a way that I don't think was obviously, it wasn't so obvious that was going to be possible in 69. But I'm much more interested in the foreign policy question. And here, I think he did buy quite a bit, and in two or three ways. The first way is the settlement terms in 72 and 73 were not what was on offer from North Vietnam before. The papers have alluded to this, but not, I think, stressed it. There were two issues, the military being the troop withdrawal, whether it be unilateral or bilateral, and the composition of the government, coalition, whether we push two out later. And I agree completely with papers. Nixon came in hoping to win and expecting, I think, to win on both. Then in May, I think, of 71, he gives up on the mutual withdrawal, and he makes a concession that the withdrawal be unilateral. One thing I'd like to hear more from the historians of is whether the people in the administration understood the importance of that. Because it does seem to me, once you've said North Vietnamese troops can stay, it would be too far to say that ended the game, and for a reason I'll come back in a minute, but it certainly loaded the dice. I mean, once you'd said that the non-communist South Vietnamese government had a really, really uphill battle, maybe it could win it, but that was an enormous concession. And I don't get the feeling from the secondary accounts I've read that Nixon and Kissinger and Laird and the others they fully understood that, but the other concession was the composition of the government, and that ended up being somewhat a compromise. I mean, Nixon and Kissinger did resist the demand to throw out Jew. They won on that, although they ended up with this complicated arrangement that you know about more than I. But it's certainly a big concession on the part of the North Vietnamese. And you can say, well, that isn't much of a concession because in the end, Du was going to lose. Well, if it wasn't so much of a concession, why didn't North Vietnam settle in the summer of 1971? I don't know. You people may know if there's an answer to that in the literature. I mean, we know much more about North Vietnamese decision-making than we did 5 years ago. I've got some of the secondary accounts, but, I'd be interested. I don't think we have a firm understanding of that. We know they didn't consider the offer enough. We know they launched the Easter 72 offensive for that reason, that they wanted to push us out, and I think basically they felt that they weren't sure they could win on their own, they weren't sure we'd pull the troops out, but anyway, they did not make the concession willingly. It took the defeat of the 1972 offensive for them to make their major concession in the summer of 1972. They felt it really mattered. Did it really matter? Didn't save Jew? I think from the Nixon-Kissinger position, and not only domestic politics, but from their view of foreign policy, it really did matter. Because for them, and certainly and for Johnson, and for all the presidents, South Vietnam didn't matter. Maybe what mattered partly was American domestic politics, but in just restricting to the international politics, what mattered for them was the image of the U.S. in the eyes of allies and adversaries, the image of American resolve, comes down partly to the domino theory that even as distinguished historians as Fred Lagavel have dismissed too hastily. And that's because they don't believe it, and therefore they think that other people who clearly are very smart don't believe it. Anyway, so we'll continue this argument. But I do think they did believe the domino theory. with at least part of their brains. I think they're ambivalent here as on so many things, but I think we've been too quick to dismiss the way this operates. And we see it. Smoking gun. Well, in Ken's, the video is great, but you know, also the paper is really good and has some in here. And let me just quote one of the things. I know the danger of quoting one thing, but I think this. But you people do it, so I can do it. Okay. If a year or two, it is Nixon, Kissinger. I've got the date, but anyway, the date really doesn't matter. If in a year or two, a year from now, it looks. If in a year or 2 years. North Vietnam gobbles up South Vietnam, we can have a viable foreign policy if it looks as if that's the result of the South Vietnamese incompetence. What was crucial for them was not what happened in Vietnam, but how it happened. If the U.S. was seen as, quote, losing Vietnam because of a failure of our efforts, that would be coded differently in the world than if Vietnam, quote, went communist, was taken over by the North because of the indigenous effort. This is not a matter of PR in the trivial sense. It's a matter of how others would then expect the U.S. to react in other challenges in the region, the rest of Asia, and even in Berlin. I think this is true for Johnson. It's true for Nixon. And it's certainly true for Kissinger. So image and reputation are very important to them, and I think for good reasons. And I think they felt, and I think you can argue they were at least partly right. If South Vietnam falls because we have forced out our ally and given in cravenly to the enemy, that's a much bigger hit on what they care about, which is not only their re-election, but American image in the world, than what they got in the end. So I think that's very important in what they bought with time. I think there's a big difference in the settlement they got and the settlement they could have gotten in 69, or at least could have gotten, maybe they could have gotten something earlier had they really unleashed force completely, but who knows. But anyway, so I think that's one thing they got. The other thing was the international context was terribly different. And by 72, we had detente with the Soviet Union. Okay, it was very fragile. We know where it ends, but it was very real. The opening to China. An American defeat in that context is very different from an American defeat in 69. 72, the Soviet Union and China have a stake, in a sense, in American and in sort of an American policy that's fairly strong. Now, they don't want us to oppose them, various areas, but still, they have a stake in detente, they have a stake in good relations, and of course, they put pressure on North Vietnam in 72 to make their concession. So I think an American, a bug out strategy to use. It looks very different in the context of 1969 international politics than it does in 1972 international politics. Whether this is not to say it was worth it. You know, part of that would depend on whether you think you could have gotten the opening to China after a defeat in Vietnam. I think if you tell me you could get the detente with the Soviet Union and an opening to China after a defeat in Vietnam, then I say get out in 69. If you tell me you can't, and that, I don't know, my crystal ball or my retrospective counterfactual ball isn't in good enough shape to answer that, but I think that's the question. Okay. Because the central thing, though, that I close that section is for the U.S., the Vietnam War was never about Vietnam, but its impact on the Cold War. And I think that's the way to approach the question. Okay, the final puzzle, which is in a sense an ahistorical one, but is this. I'm influenced by having, as many of you know, living through the period and being very much, you know, anti-war, being Berkeley in some of these years. But I don't think most people in the country, or even the informed, you know, anti-war people, say the Democrats in Congress, realized the extent of concessions Nixon had made. He had such a tough guy, you know, aura, that my own memory, and I have to go back and check the public record a little more, is that we did not realize that Nixon had agreed to that the North Vietnamese troops could stay in South Vietnam. And we didn't realize, and I mean, we are not dealing with the senator, but that whole group, and I'll just say we, just didn't realize that the thing holding the negotiations up was whether we would force Diu out. That was a lot to swallow. And I think if Nixon, sometime after May of 71, or really before he made the concession on mutual withdrawal, if he'd gone to the Democrats and said, okay, you guys, what's your position? You think we should be more flexible in negotiations. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. The big holdup is mutual troop withdrawal. I'm going to take that off the table. I'm going to concede to the North they can keep troops in South Vietnam. If you will agree to, you know, say, hey, that now the U.S. has a reasonable position, and, you know, you don't have to do a Humphrey to me, but you have to, you know, promise to back off the support, or you're going to go and say, no, what you have to do is throw out Diu from power. And I think the Democrats couldn't have said that, and many of them wouldn't have wanted to. So the question, why is Nixon, who's so shrewd in domestic politics, unable to do this? And the first thing is this really a puzzle? And you people may say it isn't for various reasons. I put it on H. Diplo. I got some interesting responses, not as much as I wanted and not enough to convince me it wasn't a puzzle. I think the answer is probably threefold, and I should put there. One is that Congress, even by the spring of 71, is you know, pretty bitter. And you have the Cooper 70, right? So you've gotten things, but still, I'm not sure that's all of it. The second part is that Nixon can't do this because he's afraid of appearing weak. It's ironic, he's told the North Vietnamese our position and told the Soviets and the Chinese, but I think his inherent fear of feeling weak for both good political reasons and psychological reasons makes it difficult for him to do that. And I think the third part, and this is my final point, sorry, is his personality. And what we've seen, you know, Ken Hughes's paper brings out so well, is Nixon can't be honest, right? If he were honest, he wouldn't be Richard Nixon. That deception and secrecy and, you know, double dealing are the core of what he is. The thought that he could take the Democrats, who he viewed as, you know, enemies, I believe, not adversaries, but enemies, that he could take them into his confidence and treat them as, you know, fellow Americans, to see, here's a policy maybe we can agree on. I think he just could not do that psychologically. Now, I'm not positive, as a card-carrying Democrat, would love to say I'm sure the Democrats would have reciprocated. I'm not sure. So there were real reasons. But why didn't he consider it? I mean, you know, you can explain maybe why he rejected this, but that I don't think he considered it. I think it's partly that he doesn't understand how much he's giving away when he agrees to the withdrawal. I mean, but that mostly he cannot treat the domestic adversaries as though maybe they had enough in common to cooperate. And so I'm happy to say that since my first political memories are of hating Richard Nixon from Helen to the Hagan Douglas thing, that in the end, even though I see there's some virtue in the Nixon policy, in the end I can come back to blaming Nixon. Thank you.
Our commentator today is Professor Philip Zelikow. He's the White Burkett Miller Professor of History at the University of Virginia and former director of the Miller Center. You saw some of the fruits of some of his initiatives this morning from the fine presentations that used some of the Presidential Recordings Project that were indeed very interesting. His distinguished career is one of excellence in academia and in government. He's the author of Germany Unified and Europe Transformed, a seminal work on important episode, the end of the Cold War. And just so that we know that not only political scientists and Democrats are cross-dressers, and Philip Zelko is also a disciplinary cross-dresser, as he also does substantial work in political science. He was a co-author and one of the redrafters of The Essence of Decision, which really reconfigured that book in an important way. He's renowned for his voluminous knowledge of diplomatic history and public policy. And in government, he is a go-to person on pressing national foreign policy issues by Democrats and Republicans alike. He was, of course, the director of the 9/11 Commission Report, the only commission report of any commission or any government document that actually sold a lot of copies and people actually read. Very notable. He served in several administrations, most recently as counselor of the Department of State, working closely with Condi Rice. Please welcome Professor Philip Zelko.
Good to be back. It's good to see all of you. The sessions this morning were splendid, and Bob Jervis's paper is very good. This is a very rich subject, and I'm going to try to limit my comments to five topics. First, I want to go over the what-if question that Bob raised in his paper and disagree with him. Second, I want to talk about their use of analogies as opposed to our use of analogies. I want to reflect a little bit on the way that historical actors themselves analogize from history in these different ways. Third, I want to talk about the issue of domestic party reputation in the politics of withdrawal, which I think has not really been raised, but is actually the most important political issue, I think. Fourth, I want to talk about asymmetries of domestic and international interest and the two-level game problem. And fifth, I want to talk about the problem of conditional commitments, and this coming directly back to a point that Bob has fruitfully broached in his opening. First, on the what-if point. The what-if point, Bob argues that it is, at least I think he introduces the possibility, which he asks folks to consider, that if the that perhaps the Nixon administration, by buying time, actually held open the door that allowed the progression and flowering of detente and the opening to China, and thereby may have offset some of the terrible costs. I take the challenge seriously, and just want to indicate that my reaction to that is probably, I think not. I think the decisive year, the fundamental year for the Nixon administration in Vietnam is 1969. And that after the decisions made in that year, especially in the fall of that year, they're basically on a road that locks them into cynicism at home and flailing to find room for a maneuver abroad, a road from which they really never depart for the remainder of the administration. And the reasons that I still think that the choices they made in the fall of 69 were probably the worst of the choices that they could have made are I'll just tick off four or five things. First is, I set a very high bar on the continuation of war. I had recently had the privilege of serving my country and working on the war in Iraq. I had nothing to do with the decisions to get into that war, and I came into administration at a point where we were being asked to clean it up. And it was in utterly terrible shape. And having spent some amount of time in hospitals in Baghdad visiting wounded soldiers, and some amount of time at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, the bar is very high, very high. Sometimes you can come away from just one of those visits and you say, I'm not sure what it is I can think of that's worth one of the patients I saw in those beds. So high bar. Second, the key I think that, frankly, the decisions of 1965 are easier to defend in some ways than the decisions of 1969, because I think that the key danger in international politics was the perceived momentum of China, especially the momentum of China in Southeast Asia, and the threat that posed, I think, a genuine threat to the whole stability of Southeast Asia and the surrounding region. I think in 1964 and 1965, that is a very serious concern, felt not only by the United States, but actually by virtually every friendly leader in East and Southeast Asia. I think the concerns about Chinese diplomatic momentum have significantly abated by 1969, mainly because of the domestic implosion of China. Therefore, I do not regard this as a linear equation. I think the 1965 concerns about Chinese advances have been significantly mitigated by 1969, and by the way, not just because of developments in Vietnam, but also because of developments elsewhere in Southeast Asia, above all in Indonesia. Second, I don't think that the key variable in the opening to China in 1972 is an American variable. I think the key variable in the opening is Chinese. We wanted the opening to China from the Johnson administration forward, as best I read the sources. And the key variable is when the Chinese would decide to do it, and the key variable for them was their relative complacency about us not being much of a threat, while the Soviets inspired a great deal of concern. But if we had withdrawn earlier, that equation would have been even more pronounced for the Chinese. Fourth, in the area of reputation, I actually find that the record of Kissinger's diplomacy is one where he is constantly trying to recover reputation, restore what seems to be a tattered garment of American prestige, and flail for the appearance of maneuver room, in fact, often using diplomatic leisure domain and sheer activity to cover the lack of underlying assets. And you may find that actually a heroic rearguard action, reminiscent of Napoleon's campaign in northern France in 1814, where he fights a series of brilliant little actions as he's falling back toward Paris. But it's not a situation where our efforts in Vietnam were really adding a lot to our prestige and maneuver room. And here's the thing I would note about that diplomacy, is the dynamic of every one of those major negotiations was we were fixed around the issue of Vietnam, and we were doing everything we could to get them to help us with the Vietnam problem, and then making trades to get that. So Vietnam, in fact, became a huge asset in the negotiations for the other side. And Dobrynin played it for all they were worth. This was the Soviet diplomacy at the height of its competence, and they knew how to do it. And the last critique I'd make is then you have to also notice the significance of the way we get the collapse in Vietnam, and then what that does for the collapse of détente in the mid-1970s, and actually the emboldenment of the Soviet Union, and then what that then does to endanger international politics and actually bring about really some quite severe global dangers in the early 1980s. All right. Second topic I wanted to come to, their use of analogies. Here I want to bring back Korea a little bit into the conversation. I just want to offer you just three hypotheses, let's say. First is, when they were making Vietnam decisions, how did they think about the lessons of Korea? My answer to that is a lot. The lessons of Korea suffuse Vietnam decisions, especially in 1965. It's 1964 and 65. And that's in my reading of the sources. So often suffuse it just at the edge of consciousness, but pop up in lots of different ways in the source material. By the way, it's very much including domestic politics, because the Democrats felt that the way they had handled the Korea War had basically caused the collapse of the Democratic Party politically and the disastrous election of 1952 and all that had flowed from that. They felt, in fact, that they had spent the last decade recovering painfully their reputation as a party that was capable of handling national security. So bad had the damage been to them in domestic politics by the disasters of 1950 and 51. Second illustration. First Iraq War, the 1991 war, and the lessons of Vietnam. How important were the lessons of Vietnam in decision-making around the first Iraq War? I was working for Brent Scowcroft back then, and so I had a little bit of a chance to look at that. And my answer to that is some. So in the first case, a lot. In the second case, some. And very much the sense of, now we're showing that we're kicking off the lessons of Vietnam. In a way. There's almost a perverse reaction. This is the not Vietnam War. This is, in a way, or it's kind of the apotheosis of Harry Summers, for those of you who follow that line of argument. Third, though, is Iraq II and the lessons of Vietnam. The current Iraq War and the lessons of Vietnam. How influential was Vietnam in decision-making surrounding this war? I think I'm quite knowledgeable about 2005 and 2006, somewhat less knowledgeable about the periods in which I was not in in the administration, but I've been trying to study the issue, partly to satisfy some of my own personal puzzles. My basic answer is actually only a little. The lessons of Vietnam have actually surprisingly little effect, except actually among a particular strand of military officers who were a minority dissident strand until David Petraeus became the commander in Iraq, and now they are the reigning faction. But that's a fairly recent development. Except for that group, lessons of Vietnam relatively modest. I was observing this with some attention because I felt like I was the only person in the upper levels of the administration in 05 and 06 who actually was both experiencing the staff work of the Iraq War, having actually studied the staff work of the Vietnam War. I mean, a lot of people had studied the Vietnam War, but actually having read the staffing papers, I mean, sense that, like, you can compare them. And I was very conscious of the Vietnam War, although I don't think the two wars are terribly analogous. But there are certain particular ideas or concepts or things from which you can borrow. For example, forgive me for saying so, but I'm the originator of Clear Holdenville, and fought in September, October 2006. And that concept is very directly inspired by vocabulary and ideas I drew out of the Vietnam literature as ways of applying and adapting to some things I had happened to see recently being done in northwestern Iraq under General Rodriguez. Not just in Tal Afar, but in other places in northwestern Iraq. But that's kind of a side digression. Perhaps the more interesting example of that digression I could cite, and you could do a whole little essay on the influence of Vietnam War on the conduct of decisions, on the conduct of the Iraq War. But I'll just offer you this story, because some of the Vietnam aficionados here will appreciate it. Is that in the late spring and early summer of 2006, I was so frustrated, in part because I had been trying for the last 8 months to make Clear Holdenville something more than a phrase in a speech, unsuccessfully. And actually pulled out Bob Comer's 1973 famous monograph, Bureaucracy Does Its Thing, which he wrote after he came back from Vietnam in the summer of 73 and he was at RAND. And I pulled that out. I hadn't looked at it in, 10 years, 15 years. And read through it, and it was so powerfully resonant. It's that I actually Xeroxed a number of pages of it, made selective excerpts, annotated it in the margins, and sent this highly selective copy, you know, with annotations, to the Secretary of State and made sure it got wider circulation. And I'm told in Iraq, this became a bit of a samizdat document, kind of passed around. Because, of course, you read some of these pages in Comer, for anyone who is in the middle of the Iraq stuff, are just almost shockingly resonant. But on there, you sound very little, disturbingly little in some ways. A third topic, domestic party reputation as the most important dimension of the politics of withdrawal. And here again, it's worth returning to Korea for a moment. As I mentioned a moment ago, the reputation of the Democratic Party for national security had been shattered by the Korean War, and the Democrats knew it. And so a lot of the dynamic of the Democratic Party, especially in the campaign of 1960, is to recover the reputation for being competent stewards of national security. That's you have to understand that background to understand why they're working so hard to run to Eisenhower's right on issues of national strength. It is to understand what the reputation they're trying to restore because of their concept of what the lessons were of Korea. Now, so bad reputation, then the Democrats are fighting to recover that reputation, which shadows Johnson's decisions on Vietnam in 64 and 65. Then, actually, the Democrats feel they have recovered their reputation as competent stewards of national security. Then think about the next generation of Democrats and their reputation from the politics of withdrawal in Vietnam. You would think the Democrats in 1976, aren't they honored by the American people as being good stewards of national security because they were elected in droves after the collapse in the election of 1976? Well, that doesn't do much to explain the election of 1980. So the Democrats, actually the wave of dovish Democrats who are reacting to Vietnam, give their party such a pronounced cast in national politics that to this very day the Democratic Party is working to labor under that burden and free themselves from it. And every pollster who works these issues will tell you what I've just told you. So, therefore, if you're having trouble understanding why the Democrats don't just cut off funds for the Iraq War, which they could have done in various ways over the past year, it's because they don't want to shatter the reputation of their party for national security to the point they feel they haven't really quite rebuilt it. And the burden they're laboring under is oddly in some way connected to Vietnam, although many of these Democrats feel that that's totally unjust because they actually were on the right side of the argument. But politically, what I think I'm describing is an important fact. So now the Democrats, as they think about the politics of withdrawal in Iraq, have to think about what the withdrawal in Iraq will look like for the reputation of the Democratic Party in national politics. Now, and this, of course, at a time when I don't think I even need to say much about the reputation of the Republican Party in national politics, but I did want to just briefly allude to Bob Jervis's puzzle, which he presented as a why Nixon doesn't reach out, and because this is struck a rather deep chord, because I was involved fairly actively in some efforts to actually get the Bush administration to reach out and find some bipartisan political understanding for the continuation of our efforts, first with the Baker-Hamilton group, which was a failure from every perspective, in my view, by the way, and there's a failure on both sides. That's a longer story. But certainly if the Bush administration failed on its end, they had some problems on their end. Okay. But then there was another opportunity at the point Bush was going to make his surge speech in January 2007. And I was asked actually by both Dan Bartlett and Steve Hadley to produce an alternative draft of that speech, which I did. To this day, I do not know why they both asked me for an alternative draft. Asked me. But I produced it. As far as I know, I don't know why they asked, and I don't know, it's had no effect on the actual speech the president gave, which was, I believe, unsuccessful politically. Whatever your view of the surge militarily in Iraq, what it did is it exaggerated the two games. So you have one game that actually might be going better, but meanwhile, in domestic politics, he basically actually burned his bridges. And so if there was any limited chance of actually building a centrist bipartisan consensus for some common approach to continuing the war, it actually has made that much more difficult to the point where it may almost be irreparable. And by the way, John McCain may find that even if he is elected, the Democratic Party may feel freed at that point out of the election season to do what it is they want to do anyway, which is end the war. And therefore, whatever is going on in Iraq, hands may be tied. Which brings me then to the fourth topic I wanted to touch on, which is this issue of the two-level game and the asymmetries of interest. So I want you to notice that there are two, basically, equations that you're trying to solve, and you're constantly trying to solve. First is an equation of what is my optimum strategy for the war I'm in the theater? And the second is what is my optimum strategy for domestic politics and, by the way, my management of policies towards the rest of the world. And domestic politics, not just around the war, but your entire domestic political agenda, which presidents always see and keep in mind. And what I find is that, just keep those two equations in mind. And then the next observation I make under this topic is my reading of the decisions of 1965 and of 1969 are as basically that in both cases, the president came up with the perfectly optimal outcome to the domestic strategy equation, and was perceived as having done as such at the time by the shrewdest observers of domestic politics. It's Nixon in the fall of 69, and Johnson summer of 65, basically, I think, squared the domestic equation about as well as could be squared with their domestic agendas in mind and their broader domestic political position, including their ratings in the polls. By the way, in my view, both of those decisions turn out to be just about the worst possible strategic decisions with respect to the theater. I actually can make arguments in both cases that are logical in favor of significant escalations of the war in both 65 and 69, overthrowing some of the parameters we were laboring under. I can make logical arguments for very rapidly drawing down that seem relatively plausible to me based on various calculations of interest and so on, especially if you can get the other country to kind of push you out so that you retain the appearance of making volitional choices. Because the worst case, of course, is where you're forced out, and it's not your volitional choice at all. And the 65 and 69 situations, they maximize their domestic equation, come up with the perfect solution at the expense of the theater equation. Then further observation at this point is to underscore Bob's point, which I think is totally right about the political psychology, which is the political psychology will induce people to believe that they have squared both equations. And they will attempt to square both equations through a combination of wishful thinking and cognitive dissonance. The optimal solution I found domestically is, in fact, the optimal solution for the theater. And then they will convince themselves that that is so, even though in both cases I think it palpably was not. And actually, to his credit in some ways, Kissinger saw that it was not at the time it was happening to him in 1969 and is flailing about it even then with, Duck Hook and that whole category of contingency plans. I was reminiscing about that earlier this year with Tony Lake. Now let me come to conclude this point, is offer you a little contrast for Iraq wars about the same kind of two-level game problem. First, in 2002, there's now beginning to get to be some interesting evidence. I'm a student of how we got into the war and made some of the catastrophic mistakes I would later have to work on. I'm just to solve some personal puzzles of my own. And there's actually a fairly critical set of non-decisions that occur in the fall of 2002. There is a key set of decisions that occur in August of 2002. Then there's a key set of, the joint staff, by the way, immediately recognizes the need to set up a very powerful planning capability for post-war Iraq, and makes a series of recommendations to do that are mainly, in my view, prescient and intelligent, and that are written up and so on, coming up from the director of the joint staff, a general named John Abizade at the time, and then up through General Myers. Essentially, those recommendations are not acted on at all. Doug Fife's best explanation he can come up with for why they are not acted on at all, and basically nothing is done for really serious post-war preparation really until Christmas time, 2002. Fife guesses, and he's very transparent about this, as he is throughout this memoir, which I think is an invaluable source of data, by the way, for historians, that it's because of politics. It's the president didn't actually want to endanger his domestic political standing by appearing to look like he was planning to go to war at a time. He wanted to make it look like he was genuinely giving diplomacy a chance in the fall of 2002, and therefore didn't want a lot of stories about setting up a significant post-war planning capability along the professional lines in which it should have been done, which is actually out of CENTCOM and not ramping up ORHA and all of that. But that's gets further in digression. But the point to note is that the president is maximizing his domestic political equation in the fall of 2002 at the cost of decisions which will later prove incredibly consequential for the theater. Because you can make an argument that the decisions that they have made by the time they go into Iraq are almost irrevocably bad in terms of that they will end up having to completely reboot the whole operation later in 2003 and then make a series of additional mistakes. But just in case you despair, and think that there's some inexorable law here at work in which the presidents will always maximize the domestic political equation at the expense of what should be done for the theater, I do want to offer a contrasting illustration of another war with Iraq, which is the one in 1990. Because the reminder about 1990 that's helpful here is that the domestic politics of that war in the fall of 1990 were much worse than the domestic politics of the Iraq War in 2002. That's a hard thing to remember. It's useful to keep in mind that on the key congressional votes, Bush 41 won his key congressional vote by 5 votes in the Senate. Bush 43 won his key congressional vote by 50 votes in the Senate. 5 versus 50. That tells you a lot about the domestic politics of the two wars. And in a situation where the domestic politics was actually much harder, Bush, in October 1990, makes a series of decisions to double the size of the American force he is going to send to the Middle East. He actually throws off constraints, running into the extremely stiff political headwind, and actually moves the whole 7th Corps out of Germany. And in other words, he does the surge before the war, which then has some consequences for the way the war turns out. So he actually he bites his domestic political parameters and actually then, I think, influences the quality of his results in the field very much, which then, by the way, of course, gave him 90% approval ratings for 10 or 15 minutes. Fifth topic, and last, is on the conditionality of commitments, another critical subject that Bob broached. Bob has already explained, and you already know the vice of an unconditional commitment to stay. All right. What I want to add to that is, please notice also the vice of the unconditional commitment to leave. To the extent you actually care about influencing your poor hapless allies in the field, who are fighting and dying and who have millions of people who care about the outcome of what you're doing and who are relying on you, in some cases quite literally, to save their lives and the lives of their children. So let's say you have this position in which, we want to influence the Iraqi government to do better in one way or another, and many Americans have their laundry list of do-betters. So I go to you and I say, if you won't do better, I'm going to leave. And if I do better, we're also going to leave. This is not a very powerful theory of persuasion, I got to tell you. So that has some biases. So then the third option is, how about a conditional approach? And I actually was involved in advocating a conditional approach during the strategy review of late 2006. It was actually one of the most important ingredients of the strategy we were advocating at the time. We've been fighting this problem of unconditional commitment for at least a year. We saw it in lots of different ways, and knew that if we didn't break that somehow, then we were going to be in a situation of commitment without influence, which is, again, almost the worst possible political situation to be in this situation, unless you're just going to take full control. And the problem with conditional commitments, which is really worth, which Bob introduced very helpfully and is worth focusing in on intensely, is political rigidity. And the political rigidity is, again, in your domestic political equation. Because I'm basically massing a weight of public opinion either to support getting in or to support getting out, and I can't fine-tune it. Because I'm putting such forces in motion that I can't manage them or manipulate them with agility. And then if I build up a weight of momentum for staying, and you see this happening right now with Obama and McCain, is one is going to represent a huge amount of commitment for getting out, and the other is going to represent a huge amount of commitment of resolve for staying the course. And then what this does then is accentuates the asymmetry problem I just referred to a moment ago, in that what clearly may be your optimal approach, which is to wield conditionality, is actually being sacrificed by the things you're having to do domestically, playing it on either side of the street. Now, by the way, I don't think this is insoluble. I actually think that you can work this, but partly you have to be willing to fight some of the parameters that people take as established parameters. And by the way, I'm also not as pessimistic as Bob is about doing conditional commitments in Iraq. That's partly because the Americans have an image of Iraq as where you basically turn it on or you turn it off. Iraq is not just one war. Iraq is at least 5 or 6 different wars, often really with quite totally different sets of combatants involved and very different political dynamics. It's very much a war fought by field grade officers at the brigade and really the battalion level. if not battalion and company level. And you can do all kinds of things in dialing conditionality right down to that Iraqi brigade, that part of the Ministry of the Interior, because they're dependent on us for so many aspects of life support, necessities of life, transport, situation awareness, and other things. As I think that there are a number of possibilities for what you can do with conditionality, but you have to be willing to do it. And of course, then you have to be willing to take some of the costs of that, which is, what if the Iraqis get so aggravated with the fact that you're wielding a conditional commitment that they say, well, then you just go. We liked you when you were unconditionally committed, but if you're going to be this way, you should leave. But then, of course, a lot of Americans say, please throw us into that bear patch, Brother Brother Wolf. And because, again, in those circumstances, if the United States is obliged to leave because the Iraqi government won't accept its wise advice, you know, not to massacre civilians and so forth, the politics of withdrawal are entirely transformed, especially if you are willing to commit to staying. So this is just an effort to suggest how the issue of conditional commitments and the question of influence is in many ways a central problem in the politics of withdrawal, because in all of these settings that I've tried to introduce, one common theme is, how does the United States retain maneuver, freedom of maneuver?
Thank you very much. Two excellent presentations, and we have time for just a couple questions. If anyone would like to pose a question or two right now, please.
Yeah, I have a question for Bob Juris. You raised this very interesting prospect of Nixon being emotionally unable to reach out to the Democrats and tell them what he was doing in the negotiations. And yet, in 72, with detente with the Soviet Union and with the opening to China, he does precisely that, and he gets enormous support from the Democrats. It's too bad that Randall walked out of the room, but his biggest supporter in 72 is Fulbright on detente and the opening to the Soviet Union. So he can do it in one sense, he can't do it in the other. There's probably an answer, but it doesn't mean that he can't reach out.
It's a good point that you mentioned it, you know, when I sat down. I don't have a good answer. I mean, I've been thinking about it a bit. It may be part, he has reason to, and maybe that sort of the you know, looking at both sides, that he may have a reason to expect that Fulbright would reciprocate, so he may have had enough confidence that he wouldn't be rebuffed. In the Vietnam case, I think by 71, that the bitterness is not, you know, is on both sides and so deep that, although I still think it would have been, from his own standpoint as well as the country's standpoint, worth his trying, may have been that the prospects weren't as good and therefore harder to confront. But no, it's a good political science point that you gotta look at the other cases, which I have not done.
Questions, please.
Question for Bob as well. You raised this issue of vital interests. Even war's a choice is sold on vital interests. And somewhere along the stage, that gets dialed down in order to facilitate withdrawal. Is there an easy answer as to how you get from A to B?
Well, two things. One, I mean, even in wars that are for vital interests that are actually fought to a victory, you see more, you know, as you people already know, a lot of concern for domestic support. I was struck by the book by Steve Casey on FDR, the way FDR tried to handle American domestic opinion during World War II, and, you know, which is sort of the easy case, war for vital interests, and we were winning. And the amount of care and concern about domestic opinion was really, I found, striking. Then on the other point, and it's a way we sort of came up in the papers before, how you can define victory or defeat. And the one problem is, of course, you care about it for both the domestic audiences and for foreign audiences. my sense on Iraq is that the foreign audiences really matter less. A lot of things matter in Iraq in terms of we withdraw, you know, how the neighbors are going to react, whether violence will be contained, all that. But it isn't, I think, for other countries as much in for us, it isn't as much of all of how they perceive us, image, reputation, you know, prestige, etc., as it was in Vietnam. But it's true that probably you've got to try to manage a disparate set of audiences, which isn't to give an answer to the question, but say that they may pull in different directions. There may be things you can do to convince your domestic politics that not you've won, you've gotten out on in a way that's satisfactory, but that may not work abroad and vice versa. So it's just a problem, it's a compound problem. And it also would be interesting to look at how other countries have handled that. It certainly is difficult, partly because I think you do a better job if you're self-conscious of what you're doing, if you really face it. But it's very hard to face it because what you're doing is accepting something that was unacceptable before, and I think that's very hard for people to do.
Last question.
The question, I guess, for both of you, actually, is it's something that you both touch on, and it concerns, I guess it concerns principally 65, but also 69, and it has to do with really America's global credibility, and Bob referred to the domino theory. And I think what I see in the record is certainly concern on the part of some members of the administration. This is again true of both 65 and 69, that those things matter. And Kissinger loved to say, you know, the America can't abandon a commitment now that four presidents and so on have made to this country and so forth. And in 65, some of those same concerns. But I'm also struck by how much less there is of this in the evidentiary record than I thought there would be. Philip referred to 65 and the concerns about a rising China, and then you made a reference to Indonesia. And I thought going into the archival work that I would see all kinds of warnings about China, how we have to do this to stop the Chinese, and how we have to keep Indonesia from going away from us, and yet it's striking sort of by its absence, which doesn't improve, it doesn't prove that it's not there, but that accounts for some of my skepticism about, I guess, the import of the domino theory.
The Indonesian part leads into something I want Phil to comment on. Two parts. First, the Indonesia thing, I've always been very puzzled, and I think is a real problem for my argument, because logically, Indonesia should make an enormous difference. And I have not gone through our guys, I've just mooched to a few people, and you know, what's striking is it doesn't seem to be. And I don't understand that. I'd love to know the complete documents of where the people, you know, at the working level writing on this, was there anything? I don't, you know. But this is partly where I hope Phil will come. And it, but it's for all of you people, the judging importance by frequency, I mean, you, if the shorthand, and it comes up in the domestic politics as well, that you go through an enormous amount of material, you know, looking for things, and there are two things. One is, of course, you do pick out, you know, the documents that are most striking, but the problem of what's real representative, and how do we get out the absences of various, the absence of discussion of domestic politics and other contexts, that question for Canada, and do those absences. And then the point of this, and it leads, I hope Phil will be able to help us, you know, what things are so deep they don't have to be said? You know, what, you know, everyone knows it, so why say it? Is that a partial explanation? I'm certainly not a complete one. And we do have the case in Vietnam where Jose Helms writes the paper that says there isn't going to be much domino. In fact, Johnson, I don't know, ignores or dismisses it. You know, what are we to make of that? And it's, you know, these absences that I think are sort of a general problem for our interpretation, whether it's done by political scientists or historians, doesn't matter. It's how we interpret absences in the record. You know, I think is a really crucial question.
Final word to Philip?
One brief comment on that point. Both in May of 1967 and November, McNamara uses the changes in Indonesia to rationalize his recommendation to de-escalate and affect the war.
Yeah, I really defer on the question of what were the motives in 65. There are people here who've forgotten more about that than I know, and they should answer. My superficial impression from the materials I've seen is actually there are many references to Asia and Southeast Asia, but they often have a ritual incantatory quality, which you may kind of begin to filter them out because they seem so rote, but they may just be kind of the rote repetition of well-known beliefs. But my point was less about what they believed to be the case and more about what, as an international historian, I believe to be the case. That is, if South Vietnam had been overrun by North Vietnam, strongly backed as it was in 1965 by China, what would have been the impact of that development on the political future of Southeast Asia and on the political momentum of Chinese communism circa 1965? That's a problematical enough question that I think it can be, one could find it genuinely troubling as an international historian with what we know now about the dynamics in these various places, aside from the question of whether or not the Johnson administration rightly or wrongly perceived that danger.
Good. Thank you very much to Bob Jervis and Philip Zelikow for wonderful presentations today.